ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय The chapter summary was read. Chapter 23, The Demigods Regain the Heavenly Planets. This chapter describes how Bali Maharaj, along with his grandfather Prahlad Maharaj, entered the planet Sutala, and how the Supreme Personality of Godhead allowed Indra to re-enter the heavenly planet. The great soul, Bali Maharaj, experienced that the highest gain in life is to attain devotional service under the shelter of the Lord's lotus feet in full surrender. Being fixed in this conclusion, his heart full of ecstatic devotion and his eyes full of tears, he offered obeisances to the Personality of Godhead and then, with his associates, entered the planet known as Sutala. Thus the Supreme Personality of Godhead satisfied the desire of Aditi and reinstalled Lord Indra. Prahlad Maharaj, being aware that Bali's release from arrest, then described the transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in this material world. Prahlad Maharaj praised the Supreme Lord for creating the material world, for being equal to everyone, and for being extremely liberal to the devotees, just like a desire tree. Indeed, Prahlad Maharaj said that the Lord is kind not only to his devotees, but also to the demons. In this way, he described the unlimited causeless mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then, with folded hands, he offered his respectful obeisances unto the Lord. And after circumambulating the Lord, he also entered the planet Sutala in accordance with the Lord's order. The Lord then ordered Sukracharya to describe Bali Maharaj's faults and discrepancies in executing the sacrificial ceremony. Sukracharya became freed from fruitive actions by chanting the holy name of the Lord, and he explained how chanting can diminish all the faults of the conditioned soul. He then completed Bali Maharaj's sacrificial ceremony. All the great saintly persons accepted Lord Vamanadeva as the benefactor of Lord Indra, because he had returned Indra to his heavenly planet. They accepted the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the maintainer of all the affairs of the universe. Being very happy, Indra, along with his associates, placed Vamanadeva before him and re-entered the heavenly planet in their airplane. Having seen the wonderful activities of Lord Vishnu in the sacrificial arena of Bali Maharaj, all the demigods, saintly persons, pitas, bhutas, and siddhas glorified the Lord again and again. The chapter concludes by saying that the most auspicious function of the conditioned soul is to chant and hear about the glorious activities of Lord Vishnu. Shisuka Uvacha, it yuktvantam purusham puratanam mahanubhavo ilasadu samanta. Badhanjal haspa kalakale chano bakyukalo gadgaraya giravhavi. Sukadeva Goswami said, when the supreme ancient eternal personality of Godhead had thus spoken to Bali Maharaj, who was universally accepted as a pure devotee of the Lord, and therefore a great soul, Bali Maharaj, his eyes filled with tears, his hands folded, and his voice faltering in devotional ecstasy, responded as follows. Text 2. Please repeat. Shri Balir Uvacha.
Shri Balir Uvacha.
Aho.
Aho.
Pranamaya.
Pranamaya.
Pritas.
Pritas.
Samudyam. Samudyama.
Samudyama.
Prapanna.
Prapanna.
Bhaktartha.
Bhaktartha.
Vidhao.
Vidhao.
Samahita.
Samahita.
Yalloka.
Yalloka.
Palais.
Palais.
Vad.
Vad.
Anugraho.
Anugraho.
Mare.
Mare.
Alabha.
Alabha.
Purvo.
Purvo.
Pasade.
Pasade.
Sure.
Sure.
Shribalir Uvacha.
Shribalir Uvacha.
Aho Prama. Aho Pranamaya Krita Samudyama.
Aho Pranamaya Krita Samudyama.
Prapanna Bhaktartha Vidau Samahita.
Prapanna Bhaktartha Vidau Samahita.
Yaloka Palais Tvaranugraho Marer.
Yaloka Palais Tvaranugraho Marer.
Kalabda Purvo Pasare Surer Pita.
Kalabda Purvo Pasare Surer Pita.
Shri Bali Uvacha.
Shri Bali Uvacha.
Bali Maharaj said.
Bali Maharaj said.
Aho.
Aho.
Alas.
Alas.
Pranamaya.
Pranamaya.
To offer my respectful obeisances.
To offer my respectful
obeisances.
Kritaha.
Kritaha. I did.
I did.
Samudyamaha.
Samudyamaha.
Only an endeavor.
Only an endeavor.
Prapanna
Bhakta.
Artha Vidhau.
In the regulative principles
observed by pure devotees.
Samahita.
Is capable.
Yet.
That.
Lokapalai.
By the leaders of various planets. Tvat
anugraha,
your causeless mercy.
Amarahi,
by the demigods.
Alabdha
purva, not achieved previously. Apasade,
unto a fallen person like me.
Asure,
belonging to the Asura community.
Arabita,
endowed.
Translation. Bali Maharaj said, what a wonderful effect there is in even attempting to offer respectful obeisances to you. I merely endeavored to offer you obeisances, but nonetheless, the attempt was as successful as those of pure devotees. The causeless mercy you have shown me, a fallen demon, was never achieved even by the demigods or the leaders of various planets. Purport. When Vamanadeva appeared before Bali Maharaj, Bali Maharaj immediately wanted to offer him respectful obeisances. But he was unable to do so because of the presence of Sukracharya and other demoniac associates. The Lord is so merciful, however, that although Bali Maharaj did not actually offer obeisances, but only endeavored to do so within his mind, the Supreme Personality of Godhead blessed him with more mercy than even the demigods could ever expect. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 2:40, Svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat. Even a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is known as Bhavagrahi Janardana because he takes only the essence of a devotee's attitude. If a devotee sincerely surrenders, the Lord, as the supersoul in everyone's heart, immediately understands this. Thus, even though externally a devotee may not render full service, he is internally sincere and serious. Oh, if he is internally sincere and serious, the Lord welcomes his service nonetheless. Thus the Lord is known as Bhavagrahi Janardana, because he takes the essence of one's devotional mentality. So Bali Maharaj is very amazed at the mentality, or not the mentality, but at the causeless mercy of Krishna. That Krishna is very, very kind in this world, and there's so many regulations, so many different things that must be done. And in this material world, if something's not completed, you don't get the result. If you only half cook something, three quarter, even if you only 9/10 cook it, it's still not cooked. It just, material world, unless it's finished, you don't get the fruit.
But here we see that Krishna, even though the activity has not been completed, and not even done, but because the mentality was there to do the activity sincerely, then Krishna takes that. That's what is essential for Krishna. Because for Krishna, it's the interaction between himself and the devotees and the living entities that inspires him. He's inspired by that interaction. The movement of the material energy, opulence in the material energy, that is not inspiring. It's nothing there. You cannot have rasa with the material energy. The material energy being dead matter, it does not, there is no interaction. So it's the least. Though we call it rasa, when the senses come in contact with the sense objects, then we will call that rasa because then something is perceived there. You know, taste. You taste something, you put something in your mouth, you perceive it. But only, it's only one-sided. The mechanics of it are still there. You have to have your the rasgula, your tongue, your mouth. You have to have your hand. You have to have the desire to taste. And because that's there, then you have to take the rasgula and put it into your mouth. And so the process that we see in rasa is there. And it's complete. Right? There's Krishna, there's the devotees, there's the desire to experience transcendental exchange, and then there's pastimes. So in one sense, it is rasa. It's defined as rasa. But the difficulty is we see it's one-sided. It's not two-sided. Because the rasgula does not get anything out of it. It does not experience anything. It cannot respond, you know? You know, it's not, how are you today, my dear Rasgula? Oh, very fine, how are you today? How is your tongue today? Tongue is okay. Yes, tongue is there. Like that, because without the tongue, what will the Rasgula do? He doesn't know your nose, he doesn't know your... I mean, little kids, of course, rasa is a little different. But on adults, then it's, it's the tongue. So then, there's no interaction. So actually we see it's selfish. It's one-sided. Our experiencing of rasa is one-sided. Though we may involve others in it. We may get someone to cook the rasgula, we may get this and that. But actually, it's not. You know, we're not... When interactions in the world, you don't touch the soul. The material activities, the soul is not touched. You touch the body, you can maybe touch the subtle body, but both are dead matter. So the problem is therefore, the relationships in this material world don't give satisfaction that we're hoping for. Right? That we wanted something, we attained it, right? Then that makes a happiness, right? You have a need, fulfilling a need creates happiness. And then the endeavor to get that is what must be done. You must make some endeavor to get that, gain that happiness. And so upon gaining what you wanted, it's in this world called happiness. But if we actually look, it can't really be defined as happiness because the soul cannot interact with the material energy. So what you have basically in the material world are the condition, living entities agreeing to take advantage of the material energy that is controlled by another living entity. Everybody has their quota of material energy. You have a body, some possessions, or some influence, some sphere of activities. And so then there's a mutual agreement that we will, you will, what things I have, you can take care of and enjoy that. And what you have, I will enjoy. And so then that is called rasa on the higher level. Right? That's called emotional exchange. Right? But it's one person experiencing the dead matter controlled by another person. They relinquish the control to let you enjoy it instead of them enjoying it. And that's called emotional exchange. It's called love, affection, all these different nice, very pleasant, poetic titles. But actually still there's no satisfaction because the soul hasn't been reached. The soul is desirous of this. The body doesn't care. Right? You find a dead body, it's not looking around for anything. It's perfectly happy to sit there. Right? So the body is not looking. Even the dead matter, the mind, intelligence, ego, these are just machines. Because the soul wants, then it moves it. Just like we have a hand. It's just a machine. We want something, it moves. And we say, no, it's moving, it's doing things. No, but the soul, by its desire, is pushing it. So the same with the subtle. The mind is being pushed. The intelligence, the ego is being pushed by the soul. The soul thinks, I will get something here. So the difficulty comes is that's why the material world itself is actually, on its own, is such a bleak picture. There's no one has really become satisfied, no one's being satisfied now, and, you know, since up to now it's been 100% dissatisfaction, we know in the future it will continue to be the same, because there won't be any change in it. Therefore, we see Bali Maharaj is so impressed here with the Lord's mercy that he has made a material endeavor, and unless the material you complete it, you don't get anything. But without completing, the Lord has, there's been exchange. And that exchange, externally we see, yes, he's given him Sutala planet, he's given him other things, but there's actual exchange on the transcendental platform. So there's real exchange. There's real rasa there. So that rasa, that is amazing. Even though it hasn't, the externals has not been performed. Right? Material activities, without the ritual, you will not get a fruit. It just doesn't work. You know, you don't put the coin in the machine, you won't get anything out. It doesn't matter how nice your mood is, how what a gentleman you are, how nicely you speak to the machine. You put in the coin, push the button, you get something. You don't do that, you won't get. So then, but the Lord is seeing the rasa on the transcendental platform. This is satisfying to the soul. Therefore, Bali Maharaj is so amazed, so impressed. It's moved him to tears and that. So this is the principle of the devotees. The devotee is looking, the soul anyway, all souls, even the dog and the bug and everything, they're looking for rasa on the platform of the soul. But they don't know how to find it. They don't know the science. So the Krishna gives the opportunity for the living entity to engage himself in what we call material rasa. Because we're conditioned to it. We think it's got something there. There is some substance to it. So therefore, he allows us to do that. But if we do it for him, it touches him, then it becomes, spiritualized. Then actually some satisfaction is there. Though the form of it isn't really giving it. That's just our conditioning thinks it's the form of it. But it's actually that interaction between us and the Lord, us and the devotees, based on the transcendental platform. Then we actually get something out of this, our stay in the material world. We both get elevated, we come to the devotional platform, and the mind and all of our material desires are also taken care of. We see Bali Maharaj, because everything is for the Lord. He's fully surrendered. Then he goes to Sutala, he has great opulence, greater than the demigods. He goes with all his family, associates, everything. Nothing is lost. Actually, more is gained. But that is not. He's not saying, my Lord, you're so nice, even though you took everything away, you gave me back. And even though I wandered to heavenly planets, therefore you gave me, a heavenly planet there. You're so nice, you fulfilled all of my material desires. We don't see him saying that. Because then that's, again, it's not complete. Because God is only providing something and you're going to enjoy that thing. So it still comes down to the material platform. It's religious, but not spiritual. That we have to understand. Religion is not spiritual. Religion, by touching God, where there's proper relationship for God's satisfaction, that's spiritual. So that makes the difference between the Srimad Bhagavatam and other aspects of religion that are described in the scriptures. That Bhagavatam touches religion to Krishna, therefore it's called Sad-Dharma. While the other books, they present religion as it is. So therefore the we see Sukadeva Goswami is showing us by his fine discretion what is the difference between them and giving us the opportunity to take advantage of this. Because the sages had asked, where is religion situated? What is the purpose? And so now he's explaining all these pastimes that point out how religion has been engaged in Krishna's service and so much result has gotten. That. So if that is there, then automatically the sensual aspects will be taken care of. Senses do not guarantee religious satisfaction or emotional satisfaction. Religious satisfaction automatically includes sensual. But both of them don't include spiritual. And when spiritual is there, then there's satisfaction if one is in the transcendental realm. And if one is in the material realm, then one's own activities of this world, being touched by Krishna, then also gives satisfaction here. So this is being brought out by this. So Krishna only sees what someone is, the mood, the purpose. It's not what he says he's doing. It's what is actually thinking, desiring. Right? If someone doesn't perform devotional activities nicely and says it's the thought that counts, Krishna sees the essence. But if the essence is laziness, then that's what Krishna sees. You know? So he sees what's inside the heart. Not what we say, not what we present, but what we actually really want. Like that. So that's what he sees. And so Prabhupada says here, if someone is sincere, then all spiritual perfection is there. Even if one doesn't have the opportunity to always be engaged fully, nicely in service. Certain situations come up, and we see here as a family person, so many distractions, but he sincerely wants to, he gets the benefit. So that is the point, is that sincerity is important. And that sincerity then means that we see it in connection to Krishna. That's what Krishna reciprocates with. Any questions or comments? Yes?
When you were saying that when Vamanadeva came there, and Bali Maharaj didn't pay obeisances because Sukacharya was there, why couldn't you just pay obeisances?
Because, see the, how you say? The technical rule is that when you're with the spiritual master, then you don't pay obeisances to others without his permission. Because our connection, basically to everything, is through the spiritual master. By the spiritual master, we learn how to perform all of the activities of this world, you know, how to be a properly behaved person, how to see things, how to do things. So our proper development and prosperity in this world is dependent upon that. Yeah, and our connection to the Supreme Lord. Like that.
Sukacharya was the spiritual master, but not in Krishna consciousness. Yes.
Yeah, so that is the problem.
Disobey?
He did. See, because the thing is the spiritual master is supposed to give permission. But since he didn't, therefore, then he had to disobey. Right? Like that. So, like that. He had to take up that. It means, yeah, he had to go to the next platform up. Because the spiritual master is supposed to reveal the... That's why it's called spiritual master, because he reveals spirit, right? He doesn't reveal matter. Right? So he teaches us how to use matter in Krishna's service. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
So if it's a matter of sincerity, the sincerity of purpose, is what Krishna accepts. And it doesn't necessarily mean exactly what we do, but how we actually feel in our heart towards Krishna. Then how does one change the condition of one's heart? In other words, it's might be a lot easier for us to just change exterior things. How does one, if one sees, well, my heart you know, I'm into Krishna, but I'm not as much as, you know, I'm not really into Krishna as much as I should be. And it seems to be that change the interior of oneself is sometimes more difficult than exchanging the exterior.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is that the exterior is actually harder to change, much, much harder. I mean, internal. Exterior is easy, because exterior, by some practice, one can change it. We see in this world, if you practice anything long enough, you become expert at it. So then, But the internal, then, we see then, how do you say, the external is, the ability externally is based on our desire. Because of our desire, then we have a particular, you know, gross and subtle body. And that particular gross and subtle body is good at the things connected to what we like that. If we have an interest in an area, then we generally find we have the ability in that area. If we don't, it means we had it before and we misused it. So the desire doesn't go away. This is the difficult part. But the body has been changed. So let's say that we are interested in something, like we like food so much, but we misuse that. So in this life we may have trouble with food. We can't digest, we can't get, though we have the interest. So like you were saying, is that the externals can be changed quite easily. But the internal, you're dealing with lifetimes. So the main thing is this, is the desire to want to change it. It's our desire that changed the external. So the desire will also change our consciousness. But we have to want that. That is the... So the idea is that since... how do you say? Means if you do something in one direction, if you want to get out of it, you reverse it and do it backwards. Right? You've walked down the wrong street, you want to get out of that, you turn around and walk back the other way. So since in the spiritual world, the living entities there, by their mood, they develop their love for Krishna. But if by our mood we become attracted to the material energy, then that then has to then create for us the subtle body and then the gross body. So then we reverse that by engaging the gross body in spiritual activities, and then working on engaging the subtle body in spiritual activities. And then, but the whole purpose is to get back to that point of the consciousness, and then turn the consciousness around to Krishna, and then go towards Krishna. Therefore, we see is that the spiritual activities will use the external activities of religion just to get us engaged, because we identify so much with the body. You know, the consciousness has gone right into matter. So if we move the matter around for spiritual purposes, then at least we're not. Then we are becoming purified because of the spiritual activity. The taste for higher activities is developed, or the habit is developed. And then also by that, how you say, we become aware of what's going on. The materialist isn't really aware. They're only aware of just how much they need to be to get their desire. You know, means those who are successful are very focused. Those who are not focused in the material world, they don't get what they want. Those who are focused, they get it. So you have to be able to concentrate on what you want. So since we want the subtler and then the transcendental, then we have to become aware of it. So we become aware of the body, the externals, you know, the cleanliness makes us aware at all times. Sometimes we, you know, devotees will find it a difficulty. You know, it's always be clean, this, you know, keep your cloth on, your dhoti and all this, it's falling off, your chadar, so many things. It makes you more and more aware of everything. What's clean, what's dirty, you've touched it, you didn't touch it, you touched it, did you touch anything else? You touched something else, has that been washed? You know, like this. So many things, you become conscious of more and more things. Then you're able to see, then if the process is proper, you go back behind that. What's the purpose of that? How are we supposed to understand it? Think about it. Then you start engaging the mind, the intelligence. We identify as a devotee. We start changing the ego. But the whole purpose is to go more subtle than that and go to the desire. So if we can change the desire, you actually change material existence. We see here, Bali Maharaj desired to surrender to the Lord, and it changed his whole existence. Everything external changed. Whatever he had went, and then it was replaced by the Lord. So it was spiritualized, the whole thing. And his consciousness then came to the transcendental platform. So we want to try to go from the gross to the subtle, but then that takes courage. That's the thing, to be able to see what nonsense is there, to be able to accept that it's there because of us and nobody else, and then desire to change that and maintain that desire, then takes some determination. But we see here that Krishna is Bhava Grahi Janardana. If he sees that, then the results are so great. We see Bali Maharaj in the last chapter. He has so much demoniac association. So he's worried that he'll lose his Krishna consciousness. But Krishna says, don't worry, because that's his sincere desire. Krishna's arranged, he won't be disturbed. So whatever we want, actually Krishna's arranging it. Whatever mentality we want, Krishna's arranging it. You know, I mean, it means you have to be quite expert to be, you know, always in demoniac consciousness. I mean, there's so many ways you could look at something. So to keep as a demoniac purist, that takes practice and endeavor and, you know, like that. To be able to always see things from the demoniac angle and never have a pious thought, it's serious work. Therefore, someone like Hiranyakashipu is lauded as the greatest. There's never been a greater demon. You know, there was not one atom that didn't go by his mind, that didn't have a demoniac, you know, view on it. Therefore, he was the biggest of demons. Like that. So that desire, if we have that desire to please Krishna, even though we find we may not be very capable, but we are sincere, then we endeavor for it, then Krishna will start to change. He'll remove. But he'll only remove them if we actually want them to go. He may remove the externals and that, you know, so there's something, but he'll test, he'll put us back in those externals. And then you'll see if there's been improvement. Then it'll be seen, do you actually want or not? So in the beginning it may see that you don't want, but you get caught up again, but you didn't want. So it's habit. But if you keep at it, then you'll see that habit starts to come down. Krishna will start to take it away. But it depends very much upon our sincerity, good association, you know, our service, study, all these different things. They all help us become more and more convinced that the material endeavor for material gain isn't worthless. Material endeavor to please Krishna, in other words, that's called religion, that is worthwhile while we're in our conditioned state and for preaching. Note otherwise, you know, nothing in the material world, either good or bad, is worthwhile. Does that make some sense? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just asking this question as a sannyasi. Now, we're talking of rasas here. Now, because you've been sannyasi for long, is there an end to a rasa as far as how does a sannyasi or one explore? Balance. Is there a subtle desire or I've seen sannyasis, they don't eat. And then they are just released. They don't get the appetite, they're very hungry. So how do they wouldn't they be sometimes they feel all I should have an ice cream today or
I say.
Or is it the satisfaction in Krishna?
It means the whole idea there's a few things are there. We're so used to the idea of karma and fruitive activities that is considered to be important. At the same time, as we discussed before, is fruitive activities are actually self-centered. So they're actually impersonal on the mundane platform. The sense meeting the sense object, it's a one-way street. And even our emotional exchange with others is still, it's only there if you're getting from them what you want. And what you're getting from them is not, you're not contacting the soul unless there is a spiritual exchange on service or discussion of Bhagavatam or, you know, something based on that level. But on the material level, you're still only contacting material energy. Albeit subtle, but it's still material. So it's impersonal, even though it looks personal. The fruit of path looks personal. At least the pious fruit of path does. The impious may not look it. Somebody just, whatever they want, they get. But that's just, it's become overt. So piety means to keep that selfishness covered. Because then, even though it's there, it doesn't bother other people. We say, well, I should be honest. But if one person's honesty disturbs another person, that's nonsense. You know, so since when does anyone have the right to disturb others? Because they want to say what they want to say and do what they want. Who are they? What is so special? You know, they got some God-given right or something? You know, the president of America signed a bill that this person can harass whoever he likes because he's special? No. Therefore, even though it may appear to be superficial, that we maintain, you know, etiquette and culture, even though we'd like to say whatever we like, do whatever we like. The point is others have their right to be able to do what they like. So when you put that all together, everybody follows the culture. So therefore, then there's very pleasant interaction. But whether it's honest or not, it's still selfish. That's the thing. But at least it's a pleasant selfish instead of a gross selfish. The point we're making is it's because of the impersonal aspect. In here, though it's lauded to be, you know, glorious and nice and emotional and interactive and all these wonderful things, but it's one-sided. You only interact with what you want to interact. You don't want to interact with someone else. You know, somebody picking up a little baby pig. Oh, you nice little pig, and someone else. Ooh, I wouldn't touch that. Right. So I mean, where's the thing? You know, where's that? You know. Understanding. No, it's always one. You just move in circles that you like to be in. That's all. You know. That's all. So then seeing it in that, then we see that that's one attachment. Though it seems to be soft, internally it's hard. Right? Then there's another attachment, and that is to detachment. You understand? Because in the material world, any endeavor will give a fruit. But that takes that endeavor, and that fruit takes maintenance. And there's nothing purely good in this world, just as there's nothing purely bad. So along with getting what you want, you get all kinds of problems along with it. Like that. So therefore, there are people who are attached to detachment. They just don't want to get the trouble of all that. So the happiness they get is from not having it, while the other person gets happy from having it. You understand? The one person is happy to eat, you know, and they're tolerant of everything else, the stomach ache, the having to take the medicine, having to sleep, or having a bad stomach, or, you know, going to the toilet, you know, like this. Someone else doesn't want any of that. So for them, they don't eat, then the stomach's okay. You know, the mind is more peaceful, they're not falling asleep, they're not having to go to the toilet. So, but they don't, you know, they miss out on the taste of the one thing, and they miss out on the taste of the other also. So therefore, it's attachment to detachment. Like that. So that's why everyone situates themselves according to, therefore it's, in devotional service, whether one's a sannyasi or a grihastha, doesn't matter. Which is best suited to the conditioned nature at the time. Someone's in the mood of detachment, then they may find it uncomfortable. They may not perform their duties very well if the attachment's too much. They'll always be trying to leave. Right? And we see like Raghunath Das. He just wanted to go. So it didn't matter. Well, unlimited wealth. There's no one on the planet now that has as much wealth as he had. The richest man today does not have the wealth he had. The richest man today, it's what? You say it's worth something, you know? A square foot in Manhattan is worth this much, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. That's today. You drop a bomb on it, no one wants to go near it. It's not worth anything. Right? You say that piece of paper is worth something.
That's if you have a piece of paper. Generally, it's in little numbers written on the screen. You know? Somebody sneezes and the numbers change. You know? That's all it is. Somebody doesn't feel good and then the whole market changes. You know? So, therefore, they don't have anything. He had 2 million gold coins per year. Gold. You know? And that's per year. And how much can you spend on rice and dal? Right? You know? So, there. His wife was more as beautiful as Lakshmi. That means Indra's wife. Of all the ladies within the realm of sense gratification, then no one's more beautiful than Indrani. So therefore, she is the goddess of fortune. The material goddess of fortune. Right? You want material wealth, it's coming from her. It's not coming from Vishnu's consort. His wife is more beautiful than her. And still, he just wanted to leave. So he didn't make a great grihastha. Right? Like that. So at the same time, as someone who has so much desire, then out of other things of prestige, this and that, if then they take up the renounced order, then it's also not good. They won't be satisfied. They won't be rightly situated. So therefore you situate. But then one would say, well, they're equal. Yes, they are, as far as opportunity to serve the Lord, it is equal. But socially there's a difference, because to go back to Godhead, we have to get out of this world. So detachment is closer to getting out than attachment to the material world. Therefore, the sannyas, the vanaprastha, are seen as senior to the grihastha. Therefore, social etiquette, that is there. But on spiritual etiquette, depends on the advancement of the individual. You may have a grihastha who is more advanced. And you see, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, so advanced. There may be so many sannyasis. You know, Prabhupada used to say his father would invite into his house 4 sadhus a day. And he had been seeing that since he was young. And so when his friend asked him to see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then he said, yeah, how many sadhus I've seen, right? You know, take 365 times 4 times, 20, And he hasn't seen one real sadhu yet. You know, so therefore, so the grihastha, that's another thing. But still, the social etiquette is followed. But when it comes to things like discussing the Bhagavatam, then you hear, who has the realization? You go and take that. You know, that's, we see Markandeya, I think it was Markandeya. Markandeya? Markandeya was the one who was supposed to die when he was 12? Okay. So Markandeya, he's Chiranjeev. He lives as long as Brahma. And so he's the oldest of all the sages, right? You won't get another sage except for Narad Muni or Brahma, okay, like that, or Prajapatis. But in sages that you see moving that are humans, no one's as old as him. So then there was an assembly of sages. He was speaking. And then at that time, Parasara Muni, Vyasadeva's father, came into the assembly. He was 9 years old at the time. So when he came into the assembly, Markandeya stood up. So since he is the senior most, except for one or two others in the universe, then all the people in the audience who, they were facing him, had their back to whoever was coming, they thought, who's coming? Must be Narad or Vyas or Narad Muni or Lord Shiva. It wasn't someone of that caliber, Then why would Markandeya be standing up? So they all turned around. They were surprised to see a 9-year-old boy. Right? And so then they were wondering what's there, And then Markandeya invited Parasara, you please come and sit. Take the asana and you explain to us, transcendental knowledge. And Parasara complained. He says, I'm just a little boy. I'm only 9 years old. And you are, so experienced and all that. But then Markandeya said, actually, in all how long I've been for, millions and millions and millions of years, I have not been as conscious, God conscious, as you have been in your 9 years. Therefore, you are older than me. So, and then Parasara sat, and then he would answer the questions of the sages.
You know. So therefore, the etiquette is there to see that it goes properly. So it's there, but at the same time, then there's the spiritual. So a grihastha would always respect the sannyasi, even if that grihastha was more spiritually more advanced. And that sannyasi socially would deal, you know, as he is, but at the same time, he has to respect that grihastha as actually senior to him. So you'll have both going on. See, we're used to always this one-way street, you know, sense object, it only goes one way. So we also are expect in relationships. I'm on top means it all just comes up. I'm on the bottom, it just goes up, you know, like this. But no, it goes both ways. You may have the king and you may have the Shudra. But the Shudra, he may be, you know, very elderly, 90 years old. Any Shudra above 90 is to be respected. And if they cross 100, then they're very, very... Everybody has to respect them. You know? So the king, he'll be young, because kings will go to the forest when they're, you know, 40, 50, like that, whenever their son is of age. So naturally that Shudra will be older. So the Shudra will be respecting the king because he's the king, and he's his shelter, he's one of his citizens. Same time as the king will be respecting him for being an elderly citizen of the community. So both will be there. But you see, so that aspect is there, but still, socially, of the two, the respectable positions, the king will take the prominence and the Shudra will follow. But still, respect is always there. This is religion, right? But it's still material, because you're respecting the guy's body. He's 80 years old. You're respecting the other person's ability and Kshatriya abilities. You're not really respecting the soul. You're respecting the gross and subtle body that each has. That's why we say the impersonal aspect. So, therefore, you'll see that that's also an aspect. Another thing, that's one side of it. So, therefore, you can have somebody who's a good sannyasi, but maybe not spiritually so advanced as someone else who may not be. Because of their attachment to detachment, they don't want to get involved in the material world. Like that. But more important is because of taste in Krishna consciousness than taste in material endeavor is lessened. And then further is lessening in the desire for it. Right? It's one thing by sadhana, somebody's, you know, very focused and so they're able to perform sadhana very nicely. The desire still may be there, but they intellectually they know it's not. So that's the first stage. But the actual stage, you'll see some hardness. But when they actually, those desires go and it's replaced with Krishna consciousness, then you'll see the softness is there, but powerful. The other was like a, how you say, it's like a, you know, material, noble qualities. But then this other becomes something else. The power is different. It's a different kind of power. Does that make sense?
Yeah. All right, there was a time in this kind of when... Maybe to some extent still there. When someone would take the grihastha ashram, it would be viewed as a step down. But actually, if we look, you know, at the sojourn in life, you know, qualified to go back to that, it would just step up.
Yeah.
So what I'm wondering is, and you know, that kind of residual mentality, you know, it's actually quite a little less than becoming grihastha. What is, you know, in the culture, what's the actual reciprocation between the brahmachari and grihastha? How should that be seen?
Yeah, it means brahmachari is considered junior to the grihastha. Like that. So even though you may have a brahmachari temple president and grihastha's working in the temple, he still has to respect the grihastha's as senior to him. But at the same time, as the grihastha's have to respect, because that's in a different line. You know, it's not ashram, it's in position. Like that. That's in the administrative. He's in a higher administrative position. So that has to be respected. So therefore you have the mutual aspect. But automatically, any grihastha is considered socially more respectable than the brahmachari. The brahmachari, by his endeavors, has become, you know, very advanced, and in this way he's become famous. Then that's another thing. That's individual, but as a group, the brahmacharis have to be respectful to the grihasthas. At the same time, as the grihasthas are kind to them. If they're young, if they're equal, then they're friends. And if they're older, they may also respect. Like that. But it's that's the general rule. So the thing is, yeah, is that? I mean, we dealt with half, but...
Yeah, thanks very much. But one other question I've got. There is one report in CC where Prabhupada says that once my disciples take the grihastha life, their spiritual advancement becomes nil. Now, presumably that's kind of a localized comment based upon things that are temporal comment based upon current happenings, perhaps in this kind of thing. There's a little disgusted maybe with the lack of responsibility perhaps is maybe collectively to demonstrate. It's from one of the points you're making, this lines up with my understanding of the philosophy, that it seems that whether Brahmacharya has to run across or sannyas, there's, according, you know, if one's situated properly, then he has equal facility for spiritual advancement.
Yeah.
And also, I thought that, you know, let's see, who was it? His god brother. Maybe it was Narayan. No, who was it? The one that gave him sannyas.
Keshavar.
And he said that, you know, you need to, if you want to preach, then you need sannyas. So, practically speaking, it may be a little greater facility than an entanglement. Like some has to be able to travel, it's a little more difficult. But, from the standpoint of preaching shakti and ability to preach, there's no real impediment for it. So, the Prabhupada tried as a grihastha to preach, but it was tough because, you got any thoughts about that? I mean, just in terms of the shakti to turn hearts and help hearts or whatever.
Well, it's just as a side point, then we'll go to the main thing. It's mentioned in the scriptures that if someone grows up as a brahmachari and never loses semen, then their influence on people is so powerful. Just seeing them, it changed. Prabhupada once said, the brahmachari should be able to, he shouldn't have to go into the building where all the businessmen are doing the business. Like you go downtown and there's so many business. He just stands in the street and the people seeing him now, they will come down to him in the street and offer obeisances. He said, that's a brahmachari. Like that. So if one follows the Vedic, it's so powerful, you know. It's so powerful. It is there. So naturally, in grihastha life, that natural influence will just be reduced something. Then it depends upon the particular qualities of the individual, his own determination, his own endeavors, his own expertise. But there, just by doing that, then the brahmachari he's empowered with that potency. So there's that one. That's not main discussion because that's not really, openly available these days. You know, but then is this whole thing is understood if we understand naishkarmya, or another term that's used in. Naishkarmya is the general term. Narad Muni uses that term. Prabhupada refers a lot to that. But in the 11th canto, we see that Krishna, he uses the term Nishkam Karma Yoga, which is probably more familiar to devotees, that's come in from Baladeva and Vishwanath. But Prabhupada uses the term Naishkarmya. So it's the same thing. So if you're talking on the platform of Naishkarmya or Nishkam Karma Yoga, technically, there's no difference between the grihastha and the sannyasa. But if you're not talking, if you're talking about sakam, then there's a lot of difference. Then the grihastha ashram is not as advantageous because of one's own so much material desire, one has to, If one wants to be satisfied, one has to fulfill those desires. So that means there'll be so much side endeavor. That means the time that you have to engage in preaching will come go down. It's just, you can't spend as much time. Though the desire may be very strong, but because other desires are there, they have to be met also. Therefore, it will create a problem. But naishkarmya means is that your performing of the grihastha duties isn't for yourself. It's for the satisfaction of the Lord. So therefore, what the person in sakam is doing for himself with great endeavor, there's no service to it. It's just material. It's nice, it's pious. You know, if he takes care of the family, it's good. You know, but it's not spiritual. But for the grihastha on the platform of naishkarmya, his performance of grihastha duties then are service to Krishna, though not as direct. It's not as direct as like chanting japa or reading Bhagavatam or, you know, when he preaches. But it is service. So therefore, he'll be purified, he'll be elevated. Like that. So it's one has to distinguish between the two. So grihastha also is, just like in sannyas, we distinguish between the impersonalists and the personalists. Is they have so much renunciation, but if it's not connected to Krishna, what's the use? So the same way the grihastha, he may have so many nice, pious, and wonderful children, wonderful wife, wonderful house, but if it's not touched to Krishna, what's the use? You know, it's like a very pleasant phantasmagoria, you know? Prabhupada uses that another, what? Will-o'-the-wisp. Yeah, it doesn't exist. It looks like it exists. On the mental platform, you seem to experience it. The mind's experiencing something, but there's nothing of substance there. So that's actually the thing, is one has to distinguish between the two. So when one does, then there's a distinction. So if someone falls into the sakam, or falls, because sakam is still pious, if one falls into impious, then naturally that's going to stop advancement. Sakam is going to slow it down very seriously. Nishkam is not going to make much difference at all. Something is there, because there is distraction. You can't put in as much time. You know, that's why we see Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he chose to remain, you know, celibate, remain a brahmachari, because then he could devote full time. While Bhakti Vinod Thakur would give most time, he was hardly in the house, but still, there was other time. He had to go and, you know, work at the office all day. You know, he had to, like, these kind of things. You know, so it was like he was doing so much more than we can even imagine a grihastha present day doing. You know, he would be probably even doing more than most sannyasis are doing. You know, sleeping 4 hours a day, writing books for 6 hours a day, like this, you know, plus 8 hours doing whatever other work is, magistrate work, and, you know, in 7.5 minutes, you know, take his bath, eat, dress, put on his tilak. You know, it's pretty good. Impressive. You know? But at the same time is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you know, of the same caliber of person, could give more. That 8 hours at the office he didn't have to spend. He could spend that for preaching. So therefore, that is why Keshav Maharaj would say, if you really want to preach, then the sannyasa is better. But it doesn't mean that everybody's not preaching. But it just means that when there's less attachments, it makes it general. If you want to do specific preaching, that's another thing.
Now, one thing about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he would try to arrange his business and his profession in such a way that he was the magistrate in Puri, mm-hmm. cleaning up all the corruption and because everything he was doing was kind of like still clearly nice timing.
Yeah, yeah.
One other question I've got is with the brahmachari, the varnic activity isn't really so.
Brahmachari's varnic activity is Brahman. Like that. Only when he takes up grihastha life, then he can choose. Then he will choose one of the four according to his nature. But a brahmachari, his lifestyle must be that of a brahman. Like you see, if a brahmachari is doing business, no one takes him seriously as a brahmachari. Like that. Because a brahmachari means he's just doing brahminical activities. He's just that he's working on the platform of naishkarmya, and he is assisting the guru.
So when we see, oftentimes, when this comes, we see the brahmacharis deputized into other varnic activities. like in the name of doing evil, but that could potentially weaken the fabric of their spiritual lives.
Could. If it's emergency, then emergencies have to be done. If it's being done, you know, fully, let's say, managing Krishna's temple, but then that's a different management than managing a business. Like that. So depending upon how they manage it also, according to their nature. If they have a brahminical nature, then managing a temple is not going to reduce. If they have a kshatriya vaishya nature, then probably the element of passion will be more strong. Then they will probably find they would be more better situated as a grihastha. While the Brahmin may be grihastha, may not, depending upon their needs. You know, so if they can maintain the brahminical standard, because Brahmins also manage. They don't do. It's a different kind of. You know, it's just like a head pujari is also managing. You know, it's like everybody has to manage. You know, you want to manage your car, you have to manage it. You know, the house, it has to be managed. But you're still not called a manager. You know, you're not an administrator as such. So the temple, if it is like an educational center, preaching center, like that, and it's worked in that way and engaging everyone, then you'll see that flavor, someone could do it, even as a brahmachari. But if it takes a different flavor, you know, there's a big emphasis on other aspects, then it may run into trouble for them. Okay.
Just out of curiosity, you were saying about the as a side comment about the power of Naishika Brahmachari.
Yeah.
So if a man hears that and he says it sounds very attractive to him, can a man who has not performed Naishika Brahmachari throughout his life, by performing Brahmachari, can he give back that kind of power?
Yeah, it says after 12 years, then it will be the same.
So 12 years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like that. So it's always means that, yes.
I was thinking that a lot of grihasthas, I think sometimes we forget the potency of what we carry with us as preachers. Mm. Even if we're thinking, well, I'm just in a gross householder, I have so many duties to perform and raising the children and maintaining the household. And I have to deal with society, outside society, so much in the course of that maintenance. But I know in my own experience, if we remember, if we carry prasad with us, whether it's a garland or samah from the deity, or whatever we even cook at home and offer to our home deity, and the persons that we're coming in contact with in society, in a small way, we may be, well, I'm no great preacher, I really don't have much of a minimal nature, this or that. But by Prabhupada's mercy, and the mercy of the previous acharyas, and the mercy of the deity, and the holy name, we actually carry a lot with us. Mm. Sometimes I think we don't give ourselves enough credit. Mm. Or, as I say, back to the previous acharyas, because they've given it to us, that even just giving some shopkeeper that you do business with some Samaha Prasad, that sometimes maybe is your preaching for now. Mm. And maybe later, when Krishna arranges your life, then be more renounced, as you say, to take a more renounced position and not have to be so caught up in the details of maintenance of life. Then you can give more. Mm. We actually can give in so many little ways, so much. We think it's a little piece of prasad. We have no idea when that person gets it, what that connection is for them back to Krishna. Mm. One kind word to some guest that's walking through the dharma. We have no idea.
Mm. Yeah, a very good point.
From them, they can take sannyas and they can be renounced and they can be brahmachari, so they can be detached. But what about women? Because they always have to be dependent, so how can they be detached? Because if the people who are still supporting them, so they have to be attached. Like father, husband, and son. So you have to be dependent. So how do you become detached? Like how do women become detached?
See, the how do you say? How do you say? The detachment in the, how do you say? The men will show in the gross body. But the detachment in the women generally doesn't necessarily have to manifest there. It's a matter of understanding that we're not the body, that we're the soul. The soul is different from the body. So what's dependent is not, is materially dependent, is not the soul. It's the gross and subtle body. It's just the way it's manufactured. So the feminine material nature, feminine nature in general is, the soul is also feminine and it's dependent upon Krishna. But that's not the discussion. What the discussion is that because Krishna, he is male, he's independent. So then the reflection here, then the men here, they're independent. And because the souls, they are dependent, when it's reflected here, then the women are dependent. It's just the nature of the gross and subtle matter. So then, but the mentality, this aspect of naishkarmya, this is the key, is that, okay, to take care of the particular feminine nature, there may be so many things that need to be done. And it's comfortable in. Like the man can be quite comfortable being in a different place constantly. But the woman may find it's not as comfortable as having some place where you can have all the things you know you need to take care of, you know, what you need. So therefore, but then it's being done because that's the need of this conditioned nature. It's not my need, it's the need of the conditioned nature. Right? Just like, let's say you have something, you know, like you have a brass pot, so it needs to be polished, right? But it's not my need, it's the need of the brass pot. And since the brass pot is in my, I'm supposed to take care of it, therefore, to fulfill its needs, I have to get, you know, some tamarind and some salt and lemon or whatever else, and I have to scrub it and wash it, and then it'll be shiny. Like that. So therefore, it's seen like that. So it's just only how much it has to be taken care of to properly maintain, like that. And depending upon the nature, the conditioned nature, it'll be more or less. Different women will be more, different. Some need more, some need less. So depending upon them, but it has to be seen, that's what's necessary. While for the man, less is actually better. When they're not dependent upon all of those things, they become strong. A man becomes strong when he has less. A woman becomes strong when she has more. I mean, of course, a limit, but it's in the house, the woman's strong. The man's weak in the house. The man's strong outside the house. The woman is weak outside because all of her paraphernalia is not there. The man doesn't need the paraphernalia, you know, like that. So therefore, you get this aspect. So the women then, if they're connected to the men, that they have the facility, so then they can take care of the nature. But generally we see it's more natural that is provided by the men. Like that. Men aren't providing, the women get it themselves. But then that time that they're getting it could be spent in taking care of it. You know? So therefore it's not as well developed. You know, just like a Brahmin, if he has to, you know, manage, do business, and, you know, do this and that, how much time he gets for study? So therefore, he won't be a good teacher. So if you want the best teacher, the Brahmins, they study and they teach. Someone else manages. Right? But if you have to manage and also worry about the finances, it's also a problem. You just manage. Someone else, and if you want to be business, you just make business. Therefore, it's divided up. So then the woman's nature is there, it's taken care of, and all those things connected with it. Then it's efficient, and the nature is satisfied. Right? The kshatriya nature is satisfied when he's doing the kshatriya. The woman is satisfied when they're doing that. But the woman goes beyond that. They know they're not that. But since it's there, that's what you have, you take care of it. And then in naishkarma, as Mataji pointed out, so many ways you can have influence on people's life. It doesn't have to... Big lectures, that's one thing. But there's also little things change people's life. You find so many things. What is it? Why did somebody become a devotee? I don't know about now. I haven't been hearing. But I know in the 70s, basically I would say probably over 90%, probably up towards 99% of devotees became devotees because of the halava. Like that. They just tasted the halava and that was it. They knew there was something different. It was spiritual, you know. It was so far out. And then all these guys with bald heads and the women are, you know, gift wrapped. And, you know, it's like there's something going on here. So then they just get involved. You know, there wasn't, you know, intellectualism wasn't a great thing. You know, I mean, in those days, hippie philosophy is a 25-word vocabulary, and it's just based on the Bob, right? It's just the mood. I mean, you know, it's like, that's all. But the discussion can simply go on between, you know what I mean? That's it.
I know what you mean.
And that's it. It's been a perfectly fruitful exchange. You know, so, you know, like that. So Halava was the big preacher. Like that. So little things like this, it doesn't matter, because the whole thing is yeah. So you just have to see is what qualities one has, what field one's comfortable in, and then through that try to connect it to Krishna. So there's no bar on anything. It's just one shouldn't feel bad, I can't preach in that field. Someone has the ability, they do. Someone like with a PhD can preach in the academic field, someone without doesn't. It does, it's unlimited fields. Like that.
But also I heard that only if the husband is so advanced, a very nice devotee, and the wife follows and serves him, and she goes back to Godhead. And also, like, whomever she's dependent on, and that he's a very nice devotee. But can women on their own also go back to Godhead? Like, more, you know, I mean, if the husband is not, you know, really advanced.
He said, can't. His point is, see, for a man, he has to think of Krishna to go back to Godhead. For a woman, they can think of Krishna and go back to Godhead, or think of a man who's thinking of Krishna. Either one will get them back to Godhead. Because of the feminine nature being dependent, therefore, it's a glory for them, that dependency. Therefore, that's why you see that there would be, like I think in the Krishna book, that they're the, or different times, Prabhupada's talking about the girls would pray to get married, but they would pray to marry a devotee. Like that, in the Vedic society. Because they understood this. They're going to be attached, so they just attach that feminine nature to the man. And they perform those duties because they're connected there. But at the same time, as the cultivation of their own Krishna consciousness is prominent. It's like the man, he has to work, do this and that, but he has to be Krishna conscious. So the woman is doing her activities, but she has to be Krishna conscious. So she has two ways. Like that. Yes.
Well, I always wondered that in Western religion, they always have the mantra. And it's very prominent in Christianity, and there's no equivalent to that at all in the Vedic tradition. And I'm wondering, I've always wondered about that. Why isn't there a place for women who want to renounce married life?
Because there's very few. It means for a temporary time, yes, but in the long term, no. It's very difficult. I mean, even in the histories, basically only hear two that I know, Gargi and Ganga Mata Goswami. Like that. You know, at a young age. When they get older, that's another thing. But then the point is they have to be detached enough they don't need the stuff. You'll notice the nunnery, they are in a nunnery. So their facilities, their rooms, their food, you know, their clothes, everything is organized. And you have to check whether the actual administration of the nunnery is done by the nuns or if it's done by some hired men or something. I don't know. You'd have to check that. Because once they have the goods, it's not so important how it was gotten. You know, the main thing is to have them. You know, men are more worried about how to get them. And once they got them, they don't know what to do with them. You know, women know what to do with them, you know, so like that. You know? You know? So it's
the process of getting it.
Yeah. So the thing is it's there, but you have to see how many. The main thing is the dedication, because you see in the Western religion also, there is no process of naishkarmya in grihastha life. You're either a grihastha, and you just do whatever you're doing. You know, there is some religious restriction, very minimal. Or you are detached and completely devoted to God. But in the Vedic system, that's one that the just doing, not being devoted, that's just called a karmi. Maybe pious, but it's just a karmi. But someone who's progressive, the Grihastha is also Naishkarmya. So you have a combination of the two. Therefore, the facility of the nunnery is available in the Grihastha ashram. It's operated according to Naishkarmya. Like that. So it's already included. Then you have the same thing again. So generally, for men, it's easier, and for women, it's more difficult, just because of the nature. Yeah. Maybe we should.
Well, as a perfect grihastha, then my question goes is, I hate to ask this question. It's just like what you said just leads to the question. So the perfect grihastha man, what he's doing is if he's a perfect grihastha man, at a certain point in his grihastha life, after the children are born, etc., what he's doing is he's running a nunnery.
If the wife is on that platform.
Yeah.
If it's not, then he's providing the needs for the wife. So, therefore, depending upon the mood of the wife, then that will be, how you say, it's a difference between pleasing her mind and senses. If that is what's giving her pleasure, or her needs, or satisfaction, or if it's performing the duties that takes care of her conditioned nature, and therefore she can connect that with Krishna. So it depends. In any case, it must be seen. Whoever you marry, you have to take care of the needs. So if you don't want to deal on the platform of Sakam, then you have to marry a girl who's on the platform of Nishkam. But in any case, because she's a girl, she has to be provided with certain facilities. Like that. So if she's on the platform Nishkam, basically it is like a nunnery. Like that. But it's all mixed together. That's the thing, the Vedic is complete. So everything's there. You know, the Grihastha is a complete unit. You know, at the same time, there's, you know, nothing in the material world. It's all dependent, ultimately, on Krishna. So when it's connected to Krishna, then all perfections are God. The man progresses in his detachment, the woman progresses in hers, the children are trained also. Same time, everybody's material and emotional needs are taken care of. You know, so it's a very perfect system, but it has to be, the mood of it is the most important to be understood, because the externals don't. Varnashram is not externals. Like you see, a Brahmin, someone who teaches. You know, he has the knowledge, he gives that knowledge. So give means practically he gets it across, people learn it. Kshatriya, it protects. It doesn't say he's, you know, gets angry at every moment and is political as anything and, you know, fights like cats and dogs. That's a description of a Shudra. A Kshatriya, he protects. Like that. Vaishya, he's very pious, he's attached to the Vedic culture because he knows Vedic culture is pious and piety gives artha. And he has all good qualities. At the same time, he's very focused on economic development. Like that. But good qualities are there. Shudra then has all very nice qualities, but is only able to assist others. On his own, he will not make much headway. He's comfortable. He may have an interest in the Brahminical Kshatriya Vaishya activities, but he himself can't lead it. So he assists someone who is leading it. That's a Shudra. So then, you see like this, that makes some sense. So it's the mood that's actually the thing. The externals are manifestations of that mood. So if you have this mood, these externals are ideal. But even if you don't have the externals, if you have the mood, then it will work. You know? It's like you want to teach a class. Okay, you have a nice classroom, it's, you know, a little isolated, you know, not from outside disturbances, you have all the paraphernalia you need for that particular subject, and, you know, all these different things, then it's nice. You know, but if you don't have, you can sit down on any veranda, and if you have the knowledge, you can teach. It may, you know, you may have to, you know, endeavor, you know, make do, but you can make it work. But if you just have a nice classroom, all the paraphernalia, but don't know, have any knowledge or how to teach, no education will go on. So sometimes devotees feel that Varnashram doesn't work in this age, or that Varnashram has failed. But the problem is Westerners are very expert at collecting things, but operating it's another thing. Like that. The operation of it was not understood. You know, I'll give just a simple example. Is if we look at Varnashram, the parents are in charge of the child. Right? Means they are the authorities. What they say goes. They set the standards, and they see that. And at the same time, as they see that everything's taken care of, we're just talking rules right here, just the dry rules. But we see an application, then it's different. The rule, is the intellectual aspect is here, but the application includes the mind and the emotions and the interaction, interpersonal interaction. So therefore, we see that the interaction between the parent and the child is very pleasant, very sweet. Even though the parents are in control, they run everything, what they say goes. It's a complete totalitarian, administration. But it doesn't carry the flavor of a dictatorship. It's something very nice. But the parent is only doing things that they feel are the best for the child. What's the best they're giving? Right? So we see the difference between the two. Now you take the same, take it into the other thing. The husband is the lord of the house, and what he says goes, and he's in charge of the wife, and he's supposed to see that she's taken care of. Okay? Now, did we operate it? You understand the point? So therefore, we didn't operate Varnashram. We just got to think, man's in control, he just tells the wife whatever she's supposed to serve, okay. But that's not Varnashram, because the application wasn't used, because the mood of the grihastha, the mood of a man, the mood of it wasn't used. They just took the external rules of it, but rules never make anything happen. The rule gives it direction, gives it focus, but it has to be applied according to the proper mood. Therefore, then there's so much trouble, and the cure is not to change the rules, because God made the rules. You can't change them. Is that we have to understand, well, what's the mood in which God wants it done. Then we find it becomes very pleasant and nice. Then the man, what he is looking for in the relationship, he is getting. What the woman's looking for in the relationship, she's getting. The children are getting what they need in the relationship. And then that family and the community, they interface, and then the community gets what they need from the family from the community, like this. It all works very nicely. Like that. So the rules simply put the things in place, but the operation is the weakness. We approach it from the external, like you said in the beginning. We approach it from the gross. But the thing is it's religion works on the platform of the mind. It includes everything, every detail of the body. But it's actually a platform of rasa on the platform of emotions, on the mind. It's not a platform of the senses. That's the Western culture. Non-Vedic cultures are rasa on the platform of the senses. Maybe personal or maybe extended. But it doesn't include the mind. Like that. If someone's religious, then there'll be some influence from that. But it's not. American culture isn't including the religiosity. It's very tolerant of it. It encourages it. But it's coming in from the religiosity. It's not the, mom and apple pie and, Uncle Sam and all that stuff. That doesn't have anything to do. It's actually coming in from, Christian faith, Judaic faith, whatever it is. There's something coming in from there. So then the so that one has to take it to the finer mood. So when that's done, then you see the interactions and everything become very, very nice. Very, very nice. Does that make any sense? Yeah.
This early 70s, when I was in England, early 70s, the culture, even in the English family, was very good. The family, everything was perfect. I see that there were so many churches and everything was perfect, it's only after the introduction of televisions and everything that the whole world is gone ahead.
Well, they changed the guru. That's the main thing.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, the one-eyed guru means if you're in England, the Church of England, the king has two eyes. Or at that time, it was Elizabeth. So it means, you know, so it has two eyes. So they changed from that guru to this. Or if you know you're a Catholic, then the priest, I mean the Pope, he has two eyes, like that. Or you know you go down the rabbi, he has two eyes, you know, like that. But the problem is they changed gurus. So therefore, then, you know, what the guru teaches changed. Because before it was based on morality is at least the upper end of sense gratification because it is controlled, restricted, and it's come from some religious system. Therefore, it has that flavor of religiosity. Though technically it's still only pranamoy. It's still only extended sense gratification. Right? Be kind to others. Why? It means makes things prosperous. That's the thing. Be nice, turn the other cheek, you know, all these different things. You know, given charity, you know, but it's for you're going to get something out of it. So it's kind of the lower end of the actual thing. It's not, it's almost. So they have experienced emotion, but they haven't experienced finer emotion connected with the spirituality. But they've experienced, you know, in general, but they've experienced, at least they've experienced the emotional dependence between individuals, which in the so that was very common before, but in the modern society, sometimes it's people haven't experienced it. You could probably find many people, you know, in their teens and 20s, who have not experienced at any point in their life an actual emotional exchange. Emotion meaning something other than just, you know, gut reactions. I mean, a dependency on, you know, on the mental plane, you know, where there's actually some, there's some sacrifice for another person, you know, and then there's an exchange based on that sacrifice. That is the Vedic system, like that. That's what relationship means. Non-Vedic then just takes the sensual, which is just, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, that's all. So what the Vedic is that that's going on because those desires are there. So the sensual part is taken care of. But the finer point is that it's an exchange sacrifice on the based on the platform of the mind for higher purpose. So when that's connected to Krishna, then it becomes spiritual. If it's not, it's just pious. It's nice. Yes.
Can you say this operational factor of having the exchange, like you're describing, you know, in answer in response to that other question about particularly in the Grihastha ashram? I'm seeing today, at least myself, that because of that having been lacking, or in some way, I don't mean the word like dysfunctional, but lacking, that a lot of Grihasthas who are reaching an age where the children are grown up now, I'm seeing so much divorce. At the age of 50, 55, there's because of that, I guess that lack of exchange, there's no manapras. They can't take the relationship. Now the duty is done. Mm. I finished with sex life, I'm beginning to work. Mm. Finished with having the children, they're gone, now they're taking care of themselves. But then you still have this couple, this married couple, who, according to religious principles, is meant to continue on in a relationship of gradual detachment from material life, by some gradual step together to Vanapras, but they're not knowing how to enter that Vanapras or even what it means, or there's no example of it, or no teaching going on, what's the next step? But I see so many of us reaching that point as we're aging, and I'm seeing so many around me, people I've known for years, good devotees. I mean, I'm not even saying that they're moving to Krishna consciousness, but the relationship can go on in Krishna consciousness to the final stages of this retirement and family life, etc.
It has to be a combination of understanding the culture and the philosophy together. Philosophy we've taken, but maybe the fine points of applying it we haven't contemplated. You know, as
Prabhu was mentioning before, it's the externals are change those habits are quite easy, but to actually contemplate the philosophy, look at it, see it and be introspective, that's more difficult. So basically is you have Krishna's designed everything, he's designed the human nature. So then you have what they call nowadays, they call midlife crisis. So that's just an inherent nature that's built into the human being. But the Vedic uses it, the Vedic causes Dvanaprastha ashram. But in the modern, it causes, you know, the next marriage. Like that. Because in the whole idea is whatever you've done when you're young, you have your plans, your visions, you work for it. And then either you get it or you don't get it. You don't get it, you're frustrated. You get it, you had it, and are frustrated. So then, if the Vedic then is that now you look at it, you wanted to be married, you wanted the children, you wanted the money, you wanted this, you wanted to be with the husband, with the wife, the whole thing. You got it, but you're still not satisfied. So then it's like it really hits home that yes, the needs of the soul and the needs of the conditioned nature are very different. So then the vanaprastha, the husband and wife, they turn their attention to the soul. So then the whole conversation, their interactions, their ideas are based around how to cultivate that rather than economic development and the whole thing. So it's natural. Is that one is going to flip. That's the natural thing. But the materialist, because he didn't get what he wanted, or he got, and it was frustrated, he thinks, well, it's this woman or this man, that's why I'm not happy. If another one will make me happy. Or, I didn't get it, you know, but it's still, you know, because I didn't get it, that's why I'm frustrated. So therefore now, you know, we're 50, now we look around and catch something. So it's a very, you'll find is that they just take, many times, they just got opposite careers, opposite this, or completely something they're totally into going. It can be any variety, depending upon the, you know, the one's training, one's culture, one's conditioned nature, you know, like that. What's the varna? What's like all these different things. It can manifest in different ways. But it's the main principle is it's built in. Because that's why vanaprastha is set at that point. Vanaprastha, sannyas, whatever is the proper thing for the situation. Like that. So it's, but devotees haven't taken properly the grihastha ashram, so those material needs weren't satisfied. So they can't, they don't realize that material needs won't give them satisfaction. Otherwise, why would they be, you know, in their 50s getting married? That means then their children are going to be growing up when they're in their 70s, if they live that long. You know? So then it's a problem. It's a big problem. But because it wasn't satisfied, and it's not the movement's fault, it's our fault. Because the movement's made of us. Means the mission of Lord Chaitanya is there, and so kindly he's allowing us to be in it. We're the ones making a mess out of the social system. You know, Lord Chaitanya is not doing it. You know, Prabhupada's not doing it. It's just, we are not applying properly what we've been given. You know, if someone, the cook, you come into the kitchen, okay, I'd like to help, what can I do? You know, I'd like to do some service for Krishna. Okay, you know, over there there's a counter, there's a bunch of potatoes, and there's a knife there. You know, we want them cut up in 1-inch cubes. And then the guy comes back all cut, this, that, bleeding and all that, and says, what's this nonsense? You know, you've engaged me in this, this is not devotee, you know. Then whose fault is it? Especially if you've been told, be very careful, it's sharp, you know, this, that, you know, told, hold this end of the knife, you know, put the sharp edge down, put the potato under the knife, you know, all these things. And then so therefore that's what Prabhu's question is, then we have to become introspective and be able to take the responsibility for our own actions. You know, of course, we're going to be influenced by others, but we, because we wanted, we're in that situation. And therefore, we're being influenced. We say, I'm being influenced, I'm not wanting, but we wanted, otherwise we wouldn't be in that position. You know, Bali Maharaj was in the whole heavenly plans because that's what he wanted. he didn't want it, he just wanted to sit under a banyan tree, I don't think he would have had it. You know? So the situation is created by yourself, though, because it may have been created long before, we're unconscious of it. And we don't know how the material world works, so we may be creating it at present, or, you know, just a few years in past, but we don't know the reaction for it. We don't know what we'll create down the line, like this. So that's the thing. So if basically it's a difficult thing, is that if they can try to understand, means it's not good if things break up and all these things, not good at all. But if that's what they have to do to progress, then someone wants to do, what can you say? Same time, it should never be philosophized that it's standard and it's okay. It's nonsense. But it may be that nonsense is necessary for one individual. But if he makes a philosophy out of it, that's the nonsense. Because so many don't. You know? So many don't. And so those who are going by nicely, and then the next generation, then, because the person will get the realization when they're, you know, 60, 70, 80, then they can give it. They should be able to give it when they're 40, 50. But at least it'll come. I'm not sure if we caught the point.
No, because it's interesting, because like you said, you get to that point of life when you look, you can look, you've been there long enough to look back. So some people look back on them.
Yeah.
And you see the children are getting older, your hair is getting grayer. You know?
Yeah.
And you look back and you say, so why am I pushing further for more material success, or for material comfort, or whatever? How much more time do I have left?
Mm.
So do I have to keep pushing anymore? I didn't finish that material desire. I didn't finish that one. I better hurry up, but I have a couple things on my list. I didn't get done yet. And then you kind of have to halt yourself and then say, well, wait a minute. I don't want to take all these things to death with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't want to be on my deathbed and I'm racing for mine with all the things I didn't get to do, all the things I regretted. Mm-hmm. That side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't do that so nicely. And I messed up over here and I hurt that one there. And I had a lot of faults. And there's a lot of stuff we're going to have to be looking at, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
When we get there, which might not be far away.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when you reach that age, when you get to a certain age, where you kind of juxtaposition, officially get you kind of juxtaposition energy, you start looking back, you can look back, and you can look forward.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to decide which way you're going, and what you're going to take with you.
Let's see. One has to just gracefully grow old, you know, like that. And then it moves on. Because it may not be, the person may not have an ideal, but that's what the philosophy is there, because they won't get it. They won't get it. That's the thing. If they would have, if it was actually so important to them, why did they join in the first place? They had all that before. It means everybody had family, had money, had this, had that, and they thought it was crazy. They took up Krishna consciousness. But because the residue of those desires were there, if they're not attended to properly, and that, then they may create problems. They may grow, or, you know, our attention falls on them like that. But at the same time, is at least from the intellectual platform, they can understand is it didn't give satisfaction then, it's not going to give now, especially when you're old, you know. But, you know, whatever. It's like you said, if you can squeeze a few more years, then the mind is always pushing, you know. Only 5 more years left, you know, it's like that. You see, that's many times a big flip. There's only a few more, you know. One too many crow's feet, and it's like, it's only a couple of years left, you know. It's now or never. And then, if they can't keep on top of it, then they lose it, you know. Same with the men. You know? So it's a, one has to, you know, your point, you have to look forward. You look back introspectively that, yes, you know, we've done all that, and just like the Bhagavatam said, what do we get from it? So then forward we move to you know, we want to go back to Godhead. That's very good. Main difficulty is not that it's happening to some individuals. Main problem is, I find, is that they make a philosophy out of it and say that it's perfectly normal, it's Kali Yuga, it's this, it's that. There's millions of people, probably, you know, who are living a much more, you know, dignified life. And they're not even devotees, you know, like that. And so there's no, and it's working for them. So why it's, so just the individual
somehow they wasn't careful. They let the weeds grow in their heart. They weren't careful, or they were offensive to devotees, or, you know, in some way they allowed the materialism to grow too much. But you'll see when they're older, they'll probably, we would hope that they would come around and understand, you know, and be able to, I say, give. Like we see, you know, a wonderful story, even devotees who never really came to that. In the last, like in L.A., a couple of devotees, the last 2 weeks of their life, they kind of like figured out as, you know, it's like, hey, you got to wake up, you know. But then, you know, their departure was, you know, quite glorious, you know, very inspiring. So it may have been, you know, quite late, but, you know, better that than not. But, you know, if you follow the process, then it should happen at a much earlier age, that one would have some years left that one can then dedicate to this. Is that okay? Yeah. Anything else? Chennai Mahesh Prabhu? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I think we'll end here.
When some devotees keep telling you that you shouldn't do this and you should be doing this, like, you know, a few things that you think that you're doing wrong, and some, so is it the influence because it's your mind that wants it, or because Krishna is trying to tell you something that you're not really right and you have to do this way?
Both. I mean, this, we always have to remember that the positive and negative go together. You have the front of the duck and you have the back of the duck. The back of the duck lays the golden eggs and the front makes a lot of noise and eats a lot. So when we say we have the desires, they both go together. So many times when it's going, when the golden egg is there, then we think it's great. When the noise and the eating is going on, then we think, what's this? I didn't want it. Where's my free will? Like that. But you bought the duck, so both halves come with it. You know. So when we have a desire, then we will find the benefits come with it. At the same time, the negative comes with it. They're equal. You know. Balance means it's equal. So much happiness is there, that same amount of distress has to be there. It won't be balanced. So that's why you see the Brahmins choose for less happiness and less problems. You know, sannyasi is even less than that. The problems are less. Happiness is less, but the problems are less. Because it'll be. The kings. Huge. I mean, Indra. It means of sense gratifiers, people who are interested in sex life, he's the top guy. It means that that enjoyment, and no demigod gets the happiness he gets. He's well above. The Gandharvas, above that, regular demigods. Above that is the demigods with the positions. And above that is then him. You know, then you start the demigods who are, you know, renounced and the sages and like that. So he's the top there. So you can imagine his happiness. But you can imagine how unhappy he was. What distress he felt when he walked out of his palace and saw Bali Maharaj walking in with millions and millions of demon soldiers. So it's balanced. You have to sit there and hide in a lotus stem, right? You know, it's not exactly, you know, how you say, you know, what do you call it? You know, say, yeah, some, you know, what is it, haute couture or something? It's nothing really happening there. It's like, it's not big enough for Urvasi to come and do a dance, you know. So it's like, the stress also is balanced to how happy they get. So the same way is that we have to see is that the good situation, the bad situations there are, they go together. So therefore, then we have to want to do the things for Krishna. Then when they're good, we're happy. When they're bad, we don't. We tolerate. That's why it says elated in happiness. That means you'll have happiness, but you shouldn't become elated that you have it. And distress will come, so you shouldn't be disturbed in distress. That it's, we'll take it that, oh, happiness doesn't come, you know, therefore you get, you know, the people very, you know, strict, and sometimes they're very, you know, how do you say, just their mood is very dry,
Because it shouldn't be any happiness. Right? Because spiritual means this is not this happiness. But anyway, that'll come anyway. But you shouldn't be elated in that this is what I wanted. No. That's just coming by the modes of nature. One is happy, it's nice, it's not nice. It's nice, it's not nice. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Chaitanya Gaura Prabhupada ki.